Hello. In my last lecture, I talked about the ending of Minoan and then Mycenaean civilizations in the Eastern Mediterranean. And this involved first a set of natural catastrophes that may or may not have directly led to the ending of Minoan civilization. Then what appears to be either a Mycenaean invasion of Crete or a dramatic increase in Mycenaean influence on the island of Crete, supplanting at least some degree of earlier Minoan civilization, particularly elite civilization. And then finally the descent in the 13th and 12th centuries BC into this long period that we call the Greek Dark Ages. There's two things that I really want to emphasize here, because we will be encountering this idea of cultural collapse and dark ages in other regions. The first is that the idea of a dark age is, to some extent at least, a cultural construction on our part, both the part of archaeologists and the part of people in general when they think about history. Really, what we need to note here is that we commonly use bodily metaphors to understand the development of cultures, of states, and of civilizations. Bodily metaphors, organic metaphors. We treat, at least when we speak about these cases, we treat them as though they're organisms. We treat ancient societies as though they're organisms, and we assume that these societies, and particularly empires and civilizations, go through periods of vigorous youth, maturity, decline, old age, senescence, and then death. An organic metaphor. It's not at all clear, though, that that is a good way of thinking about ancient societies. What's the lifespan of a civilization, for example, in those circumstances? What drives, even more fundamentally, what drives this life cycle? Is it inevitable? Is it not? Generally, the idea of culture collapse and ensuing dark ages, which is a very common understanding of history, it needs to be examined and not assumed. It's also clear that in this specific case, in the Eastern Mediterranean case, that there were, in fact, major changes in the societies of the Eastern Mediterranean before 1000 BC. And that this was broad. It didn't just involve the end of urbanism. It didn't just involve elite cultures and states. There seems to be real substantial population declines over this period around the Eastern Mediterranean, as determined by both site size and site number, both decrease, indicating that, in fact, these changes affected common people as well as elites. And what we need to remember in these cases is that when we talk about population decline, that's a good antiseptic term for what was probably a lot of suffering on the part of the people involved. So I want to keep these kind of questions at least in the back of all our minds when we're thinking about the history of ancient states and civilizations. We're now going to shift the focus of our attentions considerably, geographically, and also in terms of archaeological understandings of ancient states. I now want to talk about the development of a civilization that most Americans are not very familiar with, at least in comparison with Egypt or the Minoans. This is the sophisticated urban civilization that appeared in and around the valley of the Indus River in India and Pakistan in the 3rd millennium BC. And it deserves to get more attention than it actually does. This lack of general background on this civilization is not surprising. The Indus Valley civilization, or the Harappan civilization, as it's often called, after one of the largest of its cities, is certainly less well known to archaeologists as well than many of these other cases we've already looked at and that we will look at. In comparison to Egypt, to Mesopotamia, to the rest of the Near East, the Eastern Mediterranean, Mycenaean and Minoan civilization, the Harappan civilization was not recognized as a distinct cultural entity until the early 20th century, and its importance and its scale was not recognized until even more recent times. There had been isolated references to Harappan civilization, to Harappan urban sites, by Europeans for almost 100 years before that. Of course, local people in India and Pakistan had known about it. Discovery of an ancient civilization, in these cases, in almost every instance, really means Western discovery, academic discovery. Local people know about these places. The first excavations, then, of Harappan sites only took place in any serious way in the 1920s. But we have here an interesting observation on the, if you like, the sociology of archaeology. There's another term I've introduced, but the way archaeology gets done. Because these early excavations on Harappan sites were not being done by the right people, by academic researchers at Cambridge or Oxford or the Sorbonne or Harvard. They were being undertaken by researchers working for the Colonial Indian Archaeological Service, including Indian archaeologists. And it was assumed that anything that such people were doing was probably not going to be that important and probably was not worth widespread publication and widespread attention. And thus, these excavations on Harappan sites were not widely known beyond colonial India. They really became known to the outside world through the excavations of a British archaeologist, Sir Mortimer Wheeler, a very famous archaeologist, in the 1940s, which was very useful. This is a good thing. But Sir Mortimer Wheeler had some romantic ideas about Harappan civilization that in some ways have proved more than of a hindrance than a help in interpretation in later times. And I'll come back to some of these issues later on. Another challenge in the dissemination of information on Harappan civilization is the political tensions that have existed since independence between India and Pakistan, because many of these sites are actually in the border regions of both countries. And so the political tensions that at various times have broken out into actual warfare between the modern states of India and Pakistan have, to some degree at least, hindered our appreciation of the whole scope of Harappan civilization. By the middle of the 3rd millennium BC, scribes in Mesopotamia were already writing about a place called Malua. And this place name probably refers to the rich and powerful Harappan cities of the period. As we'll see, one of the many interesting questions posed by Harappan civilization is the nature of its relations with early dynastic and later Mesopotamia. We know relatively little about the antecedents of Harappan civilization in this region, at least as compared to Mesopotamia and the Nile Valley. Most of our evidence for sedentary life, for permanent settlement, and for the development of agriculture in Southwest Asia in this region comes from the edges of the Afghanistan plateau in modern Balochistan, as well as from excavations undertaken in northern Afghanistan in the 1960s and 1970s. And as I'm preparing these lectures in 2009, it's obvious that this is an area where, again, political events over the last 40 years have had a really dramatic effect on the ability of archaeologists to do the research on these antecedents to Harappan. So most of these earlier sites come from areas along the edge of the Afghanistan plateau and thus northwest of the Indus Valley, which in later periods would be the center of Harappan civilization. It's unclear whether equivalent earlier farming sites existed along the Indus River at the same time, but if they did exist along the Indus River, they're now buried under many meters of riverine sediments in these regions. We've seen that archaeologists faced similar challenges in the Nile Valley and in the valleys of the Tigris and Euphrates river systems. For the last 75 years, researchers have remarked upon the parallel development of state systems and urbanism in dry floodplain environments during the 3rd millennium BC. In Mesopotamia, the Nile Valley, now along the Indus, and as we will see, in other parts of the world as well. That development is unlikely to be a coincidence. It's just didn't just happen that early civilizations develop in these particular environmental zones. So what would be the factors that might be involved here? Archaeologists have in the past suggested two related sets of processes that may contribute to the development of states and civilizations in these dry river floodplains. Or perhaps I should say floodplains in dry environments, in Mesopotamia, in the Nile Valley, and now, for example, in the Indus Valley. The first of these developments is the very great agricultural potential associated with these environments, often under irrigation. The second is the centralized power and authority that some archaeologists have seen necessary for large-scale irrigation projects. Some quite influential theories of state origins have held that the origins of states and civilizations in these regions originally lay with the direction of communal labor in large-scale irrigation projects. It is quite likely that the productivity of these environments, this extraordinary productivity of river valley environments under these circumstances, has played a role in the development of states. The utility of rivers for transport and trading networks is obvious as well. But generally, it seems that large-scale centralized irrigation systems come after the appearance of states in these regions, not before that. And in some areas, for example, Egypt, they never seem to have become general at all. And it's thus unlikely that states themselves developed out of the necessity for commanding, for directing large-scale irrigation systems. Harappan civilization has its ultimate origins in local agricultural settlements like Mergar, located along the western edge of the Indus Valley and just below the highlands leading up to the Afghanistan plateau. The site of Mergar sits along an important line of communication between the Indus Valley, Balochistan, and Afghanistan. And indeed, one characteristic of site development in this area through the Harappan period involves the symbiotic relations between mountains and plains populations and the resources available in both mountains and river floodplain regions. Remember that I talked about ecotones in an earlier lecture, these zones between different environmental regions that allow the potential for access to different resources over relatively short distances. Speaking now of a natural ecotone, not the political sort. Mergar was occupied between about 7,000 and 2,500 BC. Pottery was only found in the site during the second phase of the occupation at about 5,000 BC and afterward. And Mergar seems to have been a substantial farming community through the whole period of occupation. There are some interesting questions about the domesticates, both plants and animals, in use at Mergar. The excavators found evidence for wheat, barley, dates, and jujube in the earliest levels of the site, as well as cattle, sheep, and goats. Now, remember, wheat and barley, and dates as well, are Near Eastern domesticates, part of that suite of domesticated plants that we've already encountered in the Near East and around the Eastern Mediterranean. Mergar is actually quite close to the limit of practical cultivation of these plants during this early period, as the climates further south on the Indian subcontinent actually would make that cultivation increasingly difficult. So this makes it likely that the use of these domesticated crops was borrowed from farming populations further to the west or northwest, perhaps in what's now Afghanistan or eastern Iran. Significantly, cotton may have been used during even the earliest occupation periods at Mergar as well. If so, this would be the earliest known domestication of cotton in the world. Cotton and cotton textile production played an important role in Harappan economies, and cotton textiles were probably a major export in Indus Valley trading systems. From that point of view, they would have played an analogous role to flax and linen exports in Mesopotamia. All of the domesticated animals found at Mergar had also been domesticated in the Near East as well. However, the situation is actually a little more complicated than that. The cattle are zebu, particular breed still characteristic of South Asia. And genetic evidence indicates that zebu were domesticated independently of Near Eastern cattle. It's a different domestication process from a different pre-existing wild cattle population, as also happened, as I noted, in the what's now the Eastern Sahara. So we have a variety of different domestication events for cattle, it appears. There are also possible wild ancestors of sheep and goats in the region around Mergar. The genetic evidence is less clear for those species, but it's at least possible that there were independent domestication processes for sheep and goats in South Asia as well. One continuing puzzle, and as an archaeologist, as an Africanist, I find this really quite interesting, is the appearance of sorghum and millet in later Harappan sites after about 2500 BC. So a different set of domesticates here. But what's significant is that both of these cereals, both sorghum and millet, are African domesticates, with millet at least probably cultivated along the southern edge of the Sahara. Africanists were still searching for the ultimate origins of sorghum in a particular region of sub-Saharan Africa. So one question for us then is, how did these African domesticates arrive in Pakistan and India at such an early date? How did they arrive? What were the means by which these domesticated plants were being planted? And it appears were actually already fairly important on Harappan sites by 2500 BC. We would love to know what the relationships between Central and West Africa, south of the Sahara, and India and Pakistan were at that time. Agriculture at Mergar thus seems to be a sort of a hybrid activity with some local domesticates and some ultimately, in later periods, adopted from far away. Trade seems to have been important at the site of Mergar as well, and this would be a theme in later Harappan sites, as in many other of the civilizations that we've looked at. Semi-precious stones like lapis lazuli and turquoise are found in graves and other contexts on the site of Mergar, and they probably came from Afghanistan or even Central Asia, while conch shells would have come from the Arabian Sea, more than 500 kilometers or 300 miles away. On the other hand, local copper, we've seen this before, would have been a valuable trade good for export to other communities. After 5000 BC of Mergar, there's some evidence of craft specialization on the site. It seems that particular crafts seem to be the object of a lot of attention and a lot of effort. And this is especially the case for ceramic production, and it appears weaving as well. Mergar is important in South Asian archaeology precisely because there are so few comparable sites excavated to this point, in part, as I noted, because of the political history of the area that we're talking about. As such, it's somewhat difficult to place it precisely in a larger socioeconomic or cultural context. The archaeologist Gregory Possel has provided an excellent review of the periodization of Harappan history, the way in which culture developed through the intervening centuries up to the culmination, if you like, during the mature Harappan period starting at approximately 2500 BC. What does Possel note? Well, there are approximately 20 sites in Pakistan that probably date to the period between 7000 and 5000 BC. But very few of these sites have ever seen any excavation. This period probably involved the development of a complex relationship between agricultural and pastoral activities, perhaps akin to that we've already seen in Mesopotamia and in the Levant. And as in those latter areas, this may well also have had implications for group ethnic identification. So, after 5000 BC, the number of sites increased steadily in this region. This is probably in part because more recent sites, as we might expect, tend to be better preserved. But it certainly also reflects a real increase, a significant increase, in the population of the region and in the size and stability of human settlements. Thus, for the period between 3800 and 3200 BC, for example, more than 250 sites are known, more than 10 times as many as in that earlier period, and many of these are much larger and more complex than those known from earlier times. This period is sometimes called the regionalization phase of cultural developments in and around the Indus Valley. As farming populations move across the Indus Valley itself, nearly to what's now the India-Pakistan border. So if we think of Mergar as situated on the edge of the Afghanistan plateau, we're now finding during this regionalization period a spread of agricultural communities just about to what's now the border with India. As farming spreads through the region, regional differences in material culture, by which I say material culture, archaeologists mean when they say this? The material manifestation of human activities, the artifacts and other remains that humans leave behind. So we start to see regional differences in material culture, and especially in ceramics. Although still, within a larger tradition recognizably related to that of Mergar. It's quite possible that there were regional differences among, for example, forager populations in that area in earlier times as well. But these are far less visible to archaeologists, with far fewer sites. There continues to be a general development, general cultural continuity, increases in population size during the subsequent early Harappan period, dating from about 3200 to 2600 BC as well. Almost 500 sites are known from this early Harappan period on the basis of both radiocarbon dates and or ceramic chronologies. During the early Harappan period, we see the first evidence for larger settlements in the region, including real towns like Ramanderi and Kot Digi, both of which probably housed between 3,000 and 5,000 people. And these large sites stand at the apex of regional settlement hierarchies, each surrounded by smaller villages and hamlets. And this is, of course, a pattern that we've seen in many other areas and that we will see in many other areas of the world. So we now have small population centers that occupy this central position in regional settlement hierarchies. One important question for archaeologists is whether cultural regionalization, that is this the development of different cultural zones within this region as a whole, continues to be as important in the early Harappan period as it seems to have been before that. That is, do we see the early Harappan period as resulting from parallel social and political developments taking place in different cultural, perhaps ethnic regions? Or does this first appearance of large population centers, or at least relatively large population centers, originate in a common cultural tradition that spread peaceably or by force across the area? As we'll see in the next talk, this may actually be important. Archaeologists generally do see a lot of regional differentiation during the early Harappan period, differences between ceramic assemblages, other forms of material culture, architecture in different areas. There's no good evidence for temples or palaces in these centers like Kot Digi or Ramanderi during the early Harappan period, although there might be some evidence for fortification at Kot Digi. And if so, this will be significant with regard to later times. There's strikingly little evidence of social differences within early Harappan settlements, especially if we compare these to Mesopotamia or even Egyptian sites from the periods just before urbanism and state formation appear. And this is especially the case in terms of differences between household sizes and household goods on these early Harappan sites. We're just not seeing the degree of evidence for hierarchy, social hierarchy, wealth hierarchy, that we see in some areas. Political organization around the Indus Valley during the early Harappan period remains hard to discern, hard to identify, in part because, as we'll see in the next lecture, Archaeologists are puzzled about the political forms that succeeded this period during the florescence of Harappan civilization. We might postulate regional elites living in large centers, but the data don't really allow us to go far beyond that. And we're thus going to examine some of these issues of the political and social development of Harappan civilization in the next lecture. Thank you.